If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Lighthouse Faith Podcast, Moving Forward in Truth and Love. I'm Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent for Fox News Channel and author of the book Lighthouse Faith, a paying homage to the people in your life, some well-known, others only known to you, and some you never knew personally, but they still influenced your life. That is the subject of George Weigel's new book. And George is the Distinguished Senior Fellow of Washington's Ethics and Public Policy Center and a New York Times bestselling author. And I also always like to say he's probably one of the smartest people I've ever known in my life. And I strive to be like him. So he has written several books on the Catholic Church and doctrine, as well as biographies of now St. John Paul II. This new book is a departure from the usual one-topic subjects. It's actually 68 subjects, and the title tells the whole of it. It's called Not Forgotten, Elegies for and Reminiscences of Diverse Cast of Characters, Most of Them Admirable. George Weigel joins me now. Welcome, George.
Thanks, Lauren. Good to be with you again.
Well, it's so wonderful to be with you and to have you on, because it's always nice to hear your intellectual prowess, I should say. And of course, that title of the book really, really explains and kind of is an example of your subtle wit and an extreme intellect, just sort of, you know, tell the story.
Yeah. The book, Lauren, is the product of something I noticed about a year and a half ago. I've been writing weekly newspaper columns since 1979. But I noticed in late 2019, early 2020, that I had been writing an awful lot of obituary columns recently, tributes to friends, mentors, colleagues who had left the earthly scene. And it occurred to me that I might put them together with previous such tributes I'd written in a book that really celebrates the diversity of excellence in human affairs. This book includes little portraits of political figures, church people, saints, sinners, sports figures, entertainment figures, intellectuals, ordinary people who did great things. It's really, as the subtitle says, a diverse cast of characters, most of them admirable.
You know, really, when you're talking about saints and sinners, it's absolutely true, because I was so dumbfounded. You know, you actually include Mama Cass Elliot in there. And I thought, what's that about? You know, why include someone like that?
Well, we're both ex-Baltimoreans. That's a good reason. We were both born in Baltimore. But the story of Cass Elliot and Denny Doherty, another member of the Mamas and the Papas, illustrates love gone awry. Mm. Cass Elliot, as you remember, was not the pretty girl in the Mamas and the Papas. That was Michelle Phillips. Right. Cass Elliot was vastly overweight, spectacular voice, but she also was someone deeply in love with Denny Doherty, to which he did not respond. And at the end of his life, he confessed that not accepting her love had been the greatest mistake of his life. And I thought these two, in many respects, sad people, although they made wonderful music that I continue to enjoy listening to, illustrated something about the 60s, that, you know, self-absorption never facilitates true love. And that self-absorption eventually led to an early death for Cass Elliot, drug-influenced. And it made Denny Doherty at least a bit more reflective at the end of his life as to what makes for genuine human flourishing. So there are two of the lives that illustrate along the old via negativa, if you will, not to do it, the human condition and indeed the Christian condition in the world today.
Well, that is, I mean, an example of the cautionary tale of relationships, but also of what came out of, you know, the 50s and 60s is this rampant individualism that, you know, does not pair well with lifelong love relationships. It just cannot. You know, I mean, and is that kind of how we should be looking at this, is understand it's like, this is what's wrong with, you know, one of the things that's wrong with our society today.
Well, it's gotten worse since the 60s, obviously. But we can also look on the brighter side, Lauren. There are many, many figures I sketch in this book who lived vocational lives, not just lives that are careers, but lives that are vocations, lives that are purposeful. Lives in which people were trying to conform themselves to what they believed was duty, either public duty or religious duty. Lives in which truth-telling was costly. One of the figures I sketch in here is Sophie Scholl, the young woman who was one of the White Rose anti-Nazi resistance students in Munich during the Second World War, who was eventually guillotined for her witness to the truth about Hitler. Franz Jagerstatter, who was beatified by Pope Benedict XVI several years ago, an Austrian peasant farmer who refused to be part of Hitler's war, and other brave men and women who made a mark on public life. Two kind of political bookends of this sketch of reminiscences are one Democrat, Scoop Jackson, longtime senator from Washington, Henry Hyde, longtime Republican representative from Illinois, two men of vocational living in politics, who unlike today's political environment, which has really become almost ludicrous performance art, these men understood that public office was about getting things done. It was about achievement. It was about building a more perfect union, as the preamble to the Constitution states. And it's good to be remembered that there were people like that in our lifetime.
You know, you bring up Henry Hyde, and I love what you said about Henry Hyde. You said the majesty of the rule of law. And if I'm not mistaken, it's the Hyde Amendment that is now being threatened through, that's legislation that's going through Congress right now, among other things. And tell me about Henry Hyde and why you called his section the majesty of the rule of law.
That's really a phrase from the Clinton impeachment proceedings, Lauren. Henry became the chairman of the Judiciary Committee just in time to preside over that very difficult period in our public life involving the President of the United States and charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. This was massively misreported by much of the media as either political payback or puritanical witch hunting after the Monica Lewinsky business. It was nothing of the sort. I was doing a lot of work with Henry in those days, And his point was, how can we have, as the chief enforcer of the law in the United States, the president, someone who has admitted committing crimes, perjury and obstruction of justice, for which he had been disbarred, but more to the point, for which a couple of hundred people were in federal prison. So to Henry's mind, the impeachment of President Clinton, however politically damaging it might have been to his party, was a necessity in order to remind the country that we are a government of laws and not men, that no one is above the law, that public office is at the service of the law, and that law-governed societies are morally superior to societies governed simply by the rule of force and who's got more muscle behind them. So that's one of the reasons to remember Henry Hyde. The other, of course, as you say, is that he was the undisputed leader of pro-life legislators in the Congress for well over 20 years. The Hyde Amendment kept the federal government out of the abortion business. That is now under threat from the Biden administration.
I guess that's
a serious problem.
I guess it's a good time to bring up our current president, our new president, because from a Catholic point of view, he's only the second Catholic to hold the office of the presidency. And, you know, what kind of Catholic is he? I mean, compared to the people like Henry Hyde and Daniel Patrick Moynihan?
I don't question at all President Biden's personal piety. I believe him when he says his Catholic faith means a lot to him and has been instrumental in helping him deal with some very difficult situations in his life. The deaths of his first wife and two of his children being among those enormous sorrows. Having said that, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Biden is a pretty poorly educated Catholic, a poorly catechized Catholic. He seems not to understand the first principle of Catholic social doctrine, which is the inalienable dignity and value of every human life from conception until natural death. And unfortunately, he and his administration are actively facilitating grave moral evils that fly right in the face of that first principle of Catholic social doctrine. So there's a real problem here. And it's not just a problem with President Biden. This is a problem with Speaker Pelosi, with the 13 Democrats who voted in effect, 13 Democratic senators who voted in effect in favor of infanticide when they voted against the Infants Born Alive Protection Act. This is a massive failure of education in the church. And frankly, it's a disciplinary failure as well.
You talk about, you know, politics and, you know, faith, and it is kind of accepted today that, you know, your personal life and then your political life can be two separate things. And I harken back to, you know, Governor Mario Cuomo, you know, the father of our current governor here in New York, who famously said, you know, I personally believe this and my faith believes this, but I can't impose my morality on other people or in the sense of public policy. I mean, that kind of opened the floodgates of that kind of, in my mind, I don't know, I mean, maybe you can comment on that too, but the floodgates of, you know, a politician being able to sort of put, you know, live this bifurcated life, you know, faith on one side and, you know, politics on the other. What do you think about that?
The ground for that was prepared even earlier by the really incomprehensible, in retrospect, presence in the House of Representatives for 10 years of a Jesuit priest, Robert Drynan, who was a great advocate for the abortion license defined by Roe versus Wade. That it took 10 years for the church to deal with that and for John Paul II to finally say, Father Dryden, it is against the law of the church for clerics to be in public office, so you are not to run again, really softened up the ground. The Cuomo position made no sense in 1984. Mario Cuomo was perfectly willing to impose his personal view of the moral life in matters ranging from capital punishment to tax policy to welfare policy on the people of New York. I mean, this was just nonsense to say that he couldn't impose his personal views on the abortion license on the state. It was kowtowing to the sexual revolution in the mistaken notion that abortion is basically a question of sexual morality. It is not. Abortion is about the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. It's not about the commandment number six and number nine about chaste living. And Cuomo really badly confused the public debate over all of this. And one of the other people in my gallery of characters here, Lindy Boggs.
Oh, yes, that's a funny story.
Congresswoman from Louisiana, ambassador to the Vatican, demonstrated with her life that it's quite possible to be an accomplished woman, a feminist in the sense of the equality of women and their capacities in public life, and pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
Lindy was a solid pro-lifer throughout her congressional career. And that was an important witness from both a Christian and a political point of view.
Wow. What is the story? Her daughter is Cokie Roberts. And actually, before we get to that story, because I want you to tell that story, because I think it's so fun. Let's take a break right now here on Lighthouse Faith Podcast. We'll be back right back with Michael.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Okay, we're back at Lighthouse Faith Podcast, talking with George Weigel and talking about his new book, which is really a fun book, as called Not Forgotten, Elegies for and Reminiscences of a diverse cast of characters, most of them admirable. We're talking about Lindy Boggs and Cokie Roberts, and you call it the mother-daughter act. And for good reason, because, you know, only a daughter could say to her mother what Cokie Roberts says. And Cokie Roberts, obviously, a wonderful journalist from ABC and NPR. But tell that story about what Cokie said to her mother when she was nominated to become the ambassador to the Vatican, the Holy See.
The backstory to this involves the Clinton administration wanting some payback against the Vatican for its opposition to the administration's attempt to have abortion on demand defined as a fundamental human right at the Cairo World Population Conference in 1994, at the Beijing Conference on Women in 1995. So comes 1997, it's time for a new ambassador to the Holy See. And the administration floats the names of two people who were just unacceptable to the Vatican. One was a triple divorcee who had been a bundler for the Clinton reelection campaign. I think the other was a former religious sister who was in state politics somewhere. Anyway, so when it came time to try for the third time, they said, all right, you don't want the people we want to send you. We're going to give you this 81-year-old retired member of Congress, Lindy Boggs. And Lindy didn't want to do it. She had just retired from the House of Representatives, where she had served at least, I think, 10 terms since the death of her husband, whom she succeeded. And she told Cokie, Roberts, her daughter, that she was not going to accept the nomination from President Clinton. And Cokie said to her, come on, Mom, it's the two things you like doing most in the world, going to mass and going to parties. Well, I don't know whether that did the trick, but in any event, Lindy finally accepted and did a marvelous job as the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican under some very difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
For 4 years. So it's, but that was a great line from Cokie.
But nothing disparaging about, you know, being at the Vatican. It's not really just about parties and going to mass, but that brings up Pope Francis. And that also brings up, again, the current president, Joe Biden. And because of his stance and because of its opposition, really, to church teachings, you know, you've got the Archbishop, I think, of Kansas City, who came out and basically said that, you know, Biden shouldn't even call himself Catholic for his stance on abortion. But what about the Pope? I mean, ostensibly, you could actually say that Joe Biden is probably one of the most powerful Catholics in the United States, if not the world. But and so there is this sort of sense that he kind of sets the tone for Catholic teaching or Catholic orthodoxy or what. But what about the Pope? How is the Pope supposed to handle, you know, the leader of the free world who was also Catholic, but is also advocating for things that are staunchly against church teachings? What about that?
Well, as Archbishop Corleone of San Francisco said recently when Nancy Pelosi flew off the handle on the abortion issue, politicians don't define Catholic orthodoxy or the teaching of the Catholic Church. The bishops of the church do that, and the Pope does it above all. I assume that when the Pope and the President meet, the Pope is going to ask the president what he asks every president, how can I help you? But that help ought to include, in this case, a pretty firm reminder that Mr. Biden is leading an incoherent Catholic life. Pope Francis has been very strong in his pro-life advocacy and witness. And I cannot imagine that he will not make clear to Mr. Biden in a polite but firm way that Biden's support of the abortion license is completely incongruous with his claim to be a serious Catholic. That's the best thing the Pope can do, is to get Mr. Biden thinking about this again. But his own bishop in Wilmington, Delaware, and in Washington, D.C., ought to be doing the same thing. This should have been done long ago. The fact that Mr. Biden has been on this increasingly radicalized pro-abortion trajectory for the better part of 10 or 15 years now. He once was a pro-lifer and then adjusted his attitudes and positions according to the winds of the time. This should have been done 10 or 15 years ago. And now we're in a very serious problem because of exactly what you say. I mean, whether from a theological point of view, it's the bishops and the Pope who define Catholic orthodoxy, what you say is right. If Biden's attempt to kind of have it both ways, as the president, the most visible Catholic in the country, if that becomes the new normal, then the church has got a very, very serious problem on what it regards correctly as the premier civil rights and human rights issue in our country today. If an entire class of human beings, who are indisputably human beings, the science tells us that, are declared outside the protection of the law, and their lives can be terminated at will, then no one is safe. And we've already seen the deleterious effects of this at the other end of the life spectrum, in the euthanasia debate. And this is a very sad road of public moral decay.
Yeah,
that we're going down here.
Yeah. And I want, before I forget, before we leave, because I want to talk about the Pope's upcoming visit to Iraq. Well, hopefully his upcoming visit to Iraq. I mean, it's still even, you know, a little or more than a week away, and or about a week away, a few days away, actually. And we're still kind of debating whether the COVID shutdown will actually keep him from flying to Iraq. But this is historic. There's no other pontiff who's actually been to Iraq. I think John Paul had a chance, Benedict had a chance, and I think there's some issues that came up with both of those, some security, some scheduling. I don't know which one it was, but your thoughts on Pope Francis heading to Iraq?
I hope what the visit accomplishes, Lauren, is the encouragement and heartening of all of the Christians, not just the Catholics, in Iraq. There has been an enormous out-migration of Christians of various types from Iraq over the past 17 years. The present government and its predecessors seem disinclined to take the pressure on Christians from both Shia and Sunni Muslims seriously. So if Pope Francis can encourage those Christians who have been in Iraq since apostolic times. I mean, we're talking about communities that in many cases can trace their origins back to the first century.
Yes, right.
If he can encourage them while reminding the public authorities in Iraq that there can be no stable, peaceful future for Iraq unless its multiple religious communities learn the virtues of tolerance and civility, then this will be a successful trip. It's also a very dangerous trip. I think my view is that the COVID problem is less than the security problem.
Mm.
And we'll see how this works. But those are the things that I would think he would want to accomplish, and that I hope he does. The encouragement of local Christians and a bit of truth telling to the public authorities.
You know, when I was in Rome a few years ago for a seminar, a conference on, you know, for journalists study covering the Vatican from afar, one of the experts we talked with was an expert on Islam and, you know, the Middle East. And he was very disappointed in Pope Francis's understanding of Islam and what it, how it conflicts with Christianity. And now fast forward to this trip and maybe even to Abu Dhabi from a couple of years ago. What does Pope Francis understand? He's been criticized for not really understanding the conflict that is with Islam. And does he get it? And then he wants, this is his way of dealing of sort of an ecumenism that is sort of, that is more brotherly love? Or what are your opinions about Pope Francis's understanding of Orthodoxy, of understanding of Christianity's conflicts with Islam? Your thoughts?
I think actually it was Pope Benedict who defined the issue for this century very well in his lecture in Regensburg, Germany, at his old university, when he said, essentially, look, we're going to have to bracket the theological questions between Christianity and Islam for a good long while, because we're nowhere near to getting a serious conversation going. Let's focus on whether Islam is capable of finding within its own religious tradition a way to legitimize religious tolerance and a way to legitimize the distinction between spiritual authority and political authority.
Yeah.
Those are the challenges of the moment. I don't know what Pope Francis thinks about that in my three meetings with him. We've never discussed it. I think the problem with the Abu Dhabi declaration that he signed is that it perpetuates this trope of the three monotheistic religions, as if you've got this stool called monotheism and it's got three legs on it, Judaism, mm-hmm. Christianity, and Islam. Well, that's just not true. Christianity's relationship to Judaism is entirely different from its relationship to Islam. And Islam's relationship to both Christianity and Judaism is very different.
Right.
Indeed. So it's interesting that that trope was that image of the three monotheistic faiths or Abrahamic faiths was only invented in the 1920s. And it was invented by a French Catholic scholar of the Middle East. And, you know, one understands what people are trying to do there. They're trying to find points of conversation, points of tangency, so it's not just hammer and tongs all the time. But John Paul II, who made his own serious efforts at outreach to the Islamic world, said in his book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, correctly, that Islam has a very different idea of God than Judaism and Christianity. And Islam, frankly, has a very different idea of faith than Judaism and Christianity, even though, as the Pope said, Islamic piety is very admirable. Right. And would that we were as faithful to the life of prayer as many Muslims are. So this is a very complicated business. It can't be sorted out through simply smiling. But I think those two issues that Pope Benedict raised, can Islam make its own case for religious tolerance and the separation of spiritual and political authority in a just state? Those are the priority issues for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Because
if we got those settled, if that happened, and there's some efforts to that underway, not so much in the Middle East, but in Indonesia, Malaysia, places where the development of Islam is not caught up in Sunni-Shia conflicts or Arab Middle East politics, you know, then we'd actually be getting somewhere in terms of living together in a noble way. And one of the people I discuss in Not Forgotten was an exemplar of that, the Arab scholar Fuad Ajami.
Yes, he begins the book, actually.
Yes, he does. He was a good friend and a remarkable man. Lebanese Shiite, one of the most civilized people I've ever met. And he understood this. He understood that these were the real issues. That, you know, it's 300 years from now, we can talk about the incarnation of the Son of God and the Holy Trinity. Right now, we need to talk about, you know, how we're not killing each other.
Right. You know, and just, you know, just reading these stories in this book, Not Forgotten, that you've written, I mean, this is just a wonderful, wonderful collection of stories. And then they're not just stories. I mean, they are obituaries in a sense, but they are these wonderful reflections of people with honor and virtue, many of them, and things that are not celebrated today. You know, even politicians, even, you know, people in the church, there is this lacking of the sort of sacrificial service to fellow image bearers. I remember a child study professor I've talked to a few years ago, and he said, you know, they did a study, you know, 20 years ago, I can't remember when it was, you know, asked high school students what was the most important thing to you. And, you know, the number one thing was virtue. And being popular was like, you know, number 15 on the list of 15. 20 years later, they asked the same age group, and the number one issue for them was being popular, and virtue was essentially almost last. What has happened in the last two or three decades that has created this lack of honor and virtue and sacrificial service among all people?
It's a very complicated business. Obviously, we could look to the problems of the school system. We could look to the decline of of religious faith. We could look at both the entertainment industry and mass media. I mean, how often do Hollywood and media lift up figures of virtue? At one point during the pandemic, I was watching on the treadmill in the morning the movie A Man for All Seasons. I doubt that movie could be made today because, you know, somebody would try to say, well, Thomas More really wasn't a heroic figure.
And, right.
As Hilary Mantel's novels have suggested, the real good guy in the story was Cromwell. I mean, the cynicism level has become really, really disabling. And yet, you know, there are all of these remarkable people around us. Some of the characters in my book have died quite recently. I mean, Charles Krauthammer, one of the most brilliant and bravest men I've ever met. Bill Buckley, Václav Havel, the author of The Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, Jim Billington, the Librarian of Congress, Chuck Colson, founder of Prison Fellowship, Herman Woke, the novelist, very serious, pious Jew, who witnessed to his Judaism right to his death at 103 years old. So I preferred in this book to concentrate on the good news because like most of us in the commentariat, I spend an awful lot of my time on the bad news. So it was a refreshing difference to be able to assemble a gallery of portraits of people of virtue.
Okay, before we go though, there is actually one person on the list who's not actually a person. It's a spacecraft, Pioneer 10. Now, how did that make the cut?
It was an article I wrote, I don't know, maybe even 30 years ago, when Pioneer 10 became the first man-made object to leave our solar system. And it still continued transmitting data back to Earth. And that was both an enormous technical achievement, and it was a chance to reflect upon the order built into creation. Creation is not chaotic. Genesis tells us that God brought order out of chaos, and Pioneer 10 is a reflection of that. If there had not been order in the universe, there would be no science, there would be no mathematics, there would be no technology, there would be none of the things that made the even more astonishing landing of the Perseverance rover on Mars a few days ago. I can't get enough pictures of that myself. I think it's just astonishing. And too many of our contemporaries, Lauren, I think that, you know, the cosmos is just a big accident, that it's a result of a happy combination, but a random combination of certain biochemical processes. And that really demeans us. And it demeans creation. And that little piece about Pioneer 10 from the 1980s, I wrote that in 1983, actually, and edited up a bit for this volume, is a reminder of that. And it's good to be reminded that we live in a world that's capable of being understood and explored. And in doing that, we enlarge and ennoble ourselves.
It's wonderful, wonderful. It is a fascinating book, and I'm just so excited to be reading it. And the chapters are short, so you can, you know, you can just pick out the people you want to read, really, for if you just have a short time, and just read that person, because they're all fascinating. And then they're all people, even if you don't know them, you learn so much by understanding, by reading about them, and realize, my goodness, these people of virtue, these people of power, these people of incredible intellect. And yet, you know, many people don't know about them. So, George Weigel, I so appreciate you writing this book. It's called Not Forgotten, Elegies for and Reminiscences of a diverse cast of characters, most of them admirable.
Thank you, Laura.
And thank you so much. And thank you for listening to Lighthouse Faith Podcast. I'm Lauren Green. Have a blessed day.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.